How oxygen is shipped around the body by arteries and capillaries, and it seemed to me these vessels were docking empty. Meantime, Dad was gone off courting Roxana. At this, a dread realization occurred. Since arriving at this house, we'd had no miracles whatever. I shut my eyes and went back. We'd slipped through the claws of the state patrol. We'd driven hours on an empty tank. We'd taken rooms here, and then what? You'll rightly point out plenty of subsequent wonders. Davy being encamped practically outside Roxana's door. The alighting of Roxana herself inside our motherless lives. But in that dark hour, I thought only that it had been a long time since Dad charged me in the name of God to draw my first breath. Since he walked by grace above the earth or touched a torn saddle and healed it clean. And I thought, without a miracle, exactly what chance do I have? I decided then to tell Sweet about Davy. I opened my eyes, and she was still there reading aloud, crouched forward into a verse. "I know where he is," I said. "In the mountainous Eden unseen," she replied patiently. The phrase sounded familiar, and should have, she'd only just read it. "I have a little more, if you'd like," she said, and I realized she was risking some new sundown on me. My lungs eased a quarter inch, and I nodded to her to continue. "From a spire of stone, Sonny watched for his own, for his raven-haired intrepid bride, for she'd sworn to seek his Arcadian peak, her life to spend by his side. Then a rider appeared on a day stale and seared, and approached through the undulate heat, and her horse had the stride of a wearisome ride, of a horse too long on its feet. But deep in the distance and churning up smoke, who are the riders come charging for broke?" Well, nuts, I knew who those riders were. They were some dirty posse been trying all this time to track Sonny down. Unable to do it honorably, they were now trailing his bride, his intrepid bride, to his hideout. And she so weary and faint. "What's the matter?" Swede said. For at this I felt such grief I'd taken the towel and made a tent of it over my head. "Do you hate it?" she demanded. I shook my head, but I guess in a way I did hate it. Normally I wouldn't have. Normally I'd have seen that posse, as you no doubt see it, as a chance for Sonny to shine, and in front of his wife, too. But my whole body mourned for air. I was hot and sick and wanted Dad to walk in. "It's just more trouble," I said, a great knot in my throat. "Nothing ever goes right for Sonny. Can't you make something turn out okay once?" "But it's going to turn out okay." Swede paused, alarmed enough to bend principle. "Should I tell you what's going to happen? I haven't written it yet, but listen, Reuben, I'll tell you." And she did. And as you'd expect, Sonny rode down out of his mountain and swept his brave wife from her failing mount, and there was a wondrous gunfight among the rocks, whittling down the posse quite a bit, and the two of them worked their way under relentless fire back up the mountainside, where, yes, the stick of dynamite came into play. "And then the whole valley's theirs for the rest of their lives, and apple trees and fish in the stream and good pastures for their animals," Swede said. "You see?" You know what, though? It was no relief. In fact, it was worse. For as she spoke of this perfect valley, all I could see was Davy and the rotten shack he lived in, with its windy chinks and its dark pig and its frightful nutcase awaiting the world's destruction. Arcadian Peak, my eye. Again, I was gripped with the need to spill all to Swede. I had the conviction my lungs weren't going to improve, that this time the bounce wasn't coming. Heavy with fever and unconfessed sin, I said, "Swede, will you not get mad if I tell you something?" But she said, "That's Dad," hearing the door below us. Sure enough, there was talk down there, a new voice, some boot stamping, and up they came, Dad and a slumping fellow with a brown leather bag. He was Dr. Nichols, and he looked to have wrestled lately with some grievous contagion, so blue was the skin that hung about his eyes.
"What do you do for his lungs?" the doctor inquired, taking a seat on my bed.
He shook down a thermometer and jabbed it under my tongue.
"Steam, water, and vinegar," Dad replied. "Baking soda, sometimes."
"Doesn't do any good," said Dr. Nichols. "Doesn't work. How long have you done it?
Now he was working a stethoscope's icy cup against my chest.
Since he was little?
It's a worthless treatment.
Seems to have helped, Dad said.
Might as well have been crossing your fingers,
Dr. Nichols muttered, moving the stethoscope an inch and listening again.
We'd be grateful for any alternative you might suggest, Dad said.
Dr. Nichols moved the scope again.
Breathe.
I did my best.
You got a flock of sparrows in there, boy. You coughing anything up?
No.
Feel like you need to?
I shook my head.
Turn around.
He rammed the scope between my shoulder blades. You'd think it would have warmed up.
Well, no pneumonia, not yet. Try not to get it, young man. You're a full-blown asthmatic. Has anyone told you that?
What would you advise, doctor?
Dad's delivery was crisp. You'll recall his laying Dr. Noakes out cold the night I was born.
I'd advise getting him to the hospital in Fairfax till his lungs loosen up.
All right, Dad said.
Except the hospital's full of flu.
The doctor smiled, a ghastly expression.
Influenza, the worst in years. It'd finish your boy here, I think.
Dr. Nichols plucked the thermometer and read it.
Indeed, yes. Finish him.
He enjoyed talking this way, truly. It lit him right up. Snapping open the bag, he produced a handkerchief, spread it on the bed, and laid forth a brown bottle, cap syringe, alcohol, and cotton. Though anxious regarding shots, the sight of these makings cheered me. Evidently, Dr. Nichols felt I might yet avoid being finished. He dipped up a cotton ball and asked for my arm.
I'm going to give you a little adrenaline boost.
Okay.
He had an awful time finding a vein, though. Poor Nichols. When it came to poking the needle in, he got shaky. His hand actually wobbled. I looked the other way, felt the point hit, then it was gone.
Just a second, he said.
Again the point. This time it felt hot. I looked round. He was moving it here and there under the skin.
Don't pull like that, he told me.
I wasn't pulling, but wanted to. Then he said,
oh,
like an exasperated ant, and held up the syringe which he'd broken off in my arm. So it was back to the bag for more makings. Also a tweezer. This time he took the other arm and hit it first try. I remember the solid, hot, licorice feel of the adrenaline coming in. Dad came back upstairs after Dr. Nichols left. I'd been sitting up in bed waiting to feel something, but except for a certain alertness, there was no change.
I'm sorry, Reuben, Dad said.
That's okay. It's just a little bruise. I thought he was talking about the botched needle. He sat on the bed looking slack and pale, hardly the handsome courting man of recent days. He said,
I would take your place, son.
I knew he would.
Reuben, the water and vinegar, does it help?
Most times.
You can feel things loosen up?
I'm pretty sure.
Well, Dad said, that's the treatment Dr. Noakes believes in.
It helps, really.
How about now, the adrenaline?
Yes, I told him. The truth was, while we talked, I developed the sensation of standing up. That's my best shot at describing it. When I looked down at my lap-folded hands, they appeared midgety and remote.
You should try and sleep, Dad said.
But there's little sleep for the adrenaline charged. You mostly dream of this or that noisome ordeal. For me, motors chugged unmuffled behind shut doors, obscuring shouted conversations. Tin pans rang, trains hurled by. I was trying to ask Swede why a person never hears of asthmatic outlaws. Finger in one ear, she replied, they existed but rarely excelled. She told a story about one who, in a spectacular lapse of judgment, took up burglary and continually wheezed so loud he woke his intended victims. In the dream, I was wrenching every muscle in the effort to breathe, and waking from it, the work was no less hard. Lying there, I thought of Dr. Nichols with his shaky hands and how little good he'd done me, and it seemed a strange and heartbreaking come-down that Dad, of all people, had gone and fetched him here. And I thought, too, of Jape Walzer and the way he'd removed his own mangled fingers. Not one, but two. And sewed up the places himself. And the idea occurred. If the great crowd of strangers were gathered who had in their ignorance told me, just breathe, that Walzer would stand out as the most qualified to say it. The bounce, and it was a good one, pulled in just before sunup. I went downstairs in the cool gloom, and Dad was at the kitchen table drinking coffee with Martin Andreessen.
"Morning, Rube," said the putrid Fed.
He was slouched comfortably in his chair, legs crossed, coat open. His fedora lay on the table next to Dad's King James, which was turned, I recall, to Romans.
"Morning. You're improved," Dad said, looking me over.
"A lot," I said. I wanted to be suspicious of Andreessen, but he sat there so relaxed and unshaven and apparently appreciative of hospitality. There was an empty plate on the table and a spot of frosting at the corner of his mouth. Dad, too, seemed at ease. Warm, in fact.
"I was sorry to hear about your lungs," said Andreessen.
"I'm okay." He looked at Dad, who gave him a nod.
"Listen, Rube, I hope you'll think this is good news. I've been showing your brother's picture around. Finally found the right man. Over in Amadon. He said he's seen Davy in town. Not just once. 3 or 4 times.
Andreessen waited for me to answer, as if I knew what I wanted.
"Last time was the day before yesterday," Andreessen continued. "Actually, he gave your brother a ride. Dropped him off out of town."
I have to be honest. This was kindly and quietly spoken. Andreessen seemed a different Fed from he who'd shouldered into our home that first day with his talk of nabbing. Still, his nearness to Davy raised goose flesh. I stood barefoot before him on the freezing linoleum.
"Go on, Martin," Dad said.
Andreessen opened his mouth, shut it again, shook his head.
"I just want you folks to know we're going to be careful. Stay near the phone, Jeremiah."
He got to his feet.
"Reuben, we won't hurt Davy. That's a promise. From me to you."
But I didn't want anything from him to me. It was suddenly important that he know my allegiance hadn't changed. "You can't hurt what you can't find," I replied, not looking at Dad. But Andreessen smiled as he rose and laid a hand on my shoulder, saying,
"There you go."
He went out the door, all business, setting the felt fedora on his head, my enemy. That afternoon, I went outside on every excuse. After such a scare, they were all against it, but I was an exemplary weasel now and eased out the back in my coat and hood, breathing through a scarf to warm the air. I prayed, but the prayers were tangled and dissenting. I prayed the Lord would sort them out and answer as needed. Above all, that he would hurry, for Andreessen was closing in. He told Dad to wait by the phone. I walked up and down beside the house, attempting to pray as Dad did, trying to picture God listening to me, but he remained unseeable, just the usual lit cloud, and in minutes the walking wore me out. I went inside and was rebuked by Swede for taking chances. She had no idea. We ate some ginger snaps and repaired to the living room, where I stretched myself on the couch. The idea was to feign sleep until Swede went upstairs and then pop outside. But I dropped off for real and dreamed a river of horses flowing along between banks, manes rippling, backs streaming sun. I woke inside a strange calm, recognizable as defeat. Light entered the house, pink and orange. I straggled outside, leaned against the house, and squinted at the backlit hills. The light was expiring. Already it was like looking into deep tea-colored water. I didn't, in fact, see Davy. But somewhere on the side of the darkening hill, a horse lifted its voice to neigh. The sound had the clear distance of history. I was to have one last night in the hills, another starry one, as you will hear, but with a moist hush to the air that was like something at full draw, a breath, an arrow. Jape Walzer was busy shoeing Fry. Who'd ever built the place had left behind an anvil and a makeshift forge. Jape had tacked new leathers to a bellows and was working up a glow that lit the shed.
"Reuben, I thank you," he said, when Davy had ushered me in and I'd said my piece.
That was it. He thanked me for the information and seemed otherwise unconcerned.
"He said they're getting close," I reiterated, unsure whether Walzer had understood.
He stopped working the bellows. On the orange forge lay a horseshoe like a black cutout of itself. He picked it up with a set of long-handled tongs and looked it over doubtfully.
"Fry," he said to the horse, who stood short rope to a ring in the wall, "let's try this on. Davy, his head."
Davy took the bridle in both hands and whispered compliments to Fry, while Walzer leaned against the horse's left hip and picked up his foot. In the glow, I could see fresh scrapes where Walzer had filed the hoof smooth. I could see nail holes from the previous shoe.
"It's always the back left one he throws," Walzer said pleasantly, laying the hot shoe against the hoof. "I don't know why."
It was plain he liked the work. I said, "It's just he told Dad to stay by the phone." Walzer set down the hoof and replaced the shoe in the forge. When he looked at me from under those brows, I knew I'd said everything on the matter. Pumping the bellows, he said,
"Reuben, look at these coals."
They were beautiful, a breathtaking black-webbed orange.
"When they're like that, when they look like a jack-o'-lantern, they aren't hot enough."
"They aren't?"
"No, sir, not hot enough to soften that shoe."
He nodded at a stack of cut boards in the corner opposite Fry.
"If you'll feed some of those to the fire while I'm working the bellows, believe me, Reuben, we'll make some heat."
What else could I do? Forgetting Andreessen for the moment, I gave myself to the allure of the forge. It had a small steel door that Walzer swung open. The firebox was a mere cozy flame, and I fed it full of boards. Walzer slammed it shut and commenced pumping, and shortly the wood hissed to incandescence, and the wind blew in the forge until I heard voices inside it.
"Good, Reuben,"
Walzer said. He was panting. Steam came off his shirt.
"You see what you've done? Look at the coals."
There was now only the faintest orange about them. As the afternoon sun is orange, they were white. Still, they breathed. Already, the edges of the horseshoe were white, too. This time it smoked when he lifted it to Fry's hoof. Fry snuffed and hopped, but was well pinned. Walzer wasted no time but laid shoe to anvil. A few strokes, and he had it to size. He was dexterous for a man minus two left-hand fingers. Bent over Fry's upraised hoof, he reached to his mouth for a nail. He drew a small hammer from his boot top and tapped the nail till its point emerged from the hoof's clean slope an inch above the shoe. He drove a second nail, spat the rest into his palm, and looked me over.
"Reuben, come finish."
Walzer beckoned, hoof locked in his knees, wool shirt rolled to the elbows. He was sweating in the red gloom.
"Nail it home," he said.
I took the hammer. He showed me how to set the nail at the proper outward angle. Davy told Fry he was a good horse, a handsome horse. To this I would add long suffering. Aiming carefully at the nail, I tapped faintly away until Walzer said,
"Do you do everything the same way you breathe? Whack it."
So I whacked it, grateful for Fry's resignation and at the nail's progress down and through. I set the remaining nails, and Walzer produced, again from his boot top, a set of snips and cut the nail points off flush with the hoof. He pocketed the points and set the hoof back on the ground, patting the ankle above it.
"Fry,"
he said fondly, then,
"thank you, Reuben. Well done."
I looked at Davy, who winked. The forge was ebbing. It must have been cold in the three-walled shed, but I was warm and glad to be there. We ate a midnight supper in the shack, and still Walzer would hear nothing of Andreessen. His disinterest was stunning. He turned the conversation to politics, astronomy, the science of well drilling, the superiority of beaver felt over wool. He claimed to have been born with no sense of smell, but with extraordinary and compensatory taste buds. He never salted his food, but accepted it as given, its natural flavor being satisfactory.
"For example, your meat there? I suspect you find it bland."
It was a little lump of gray meat on a tin plate. It and a boiled potato were supper. There they lay, all tired out. "It's fine," I replied. Of course it wasn't yams and sausages. Walzer said,
"It's bland. Pork is bland meat, and people season it to their senseless palates. Take a bite, Reuben. Describe the flavor."
I bit. The pork had been boiled a long time. Indeed, it bore no trace of salt. It was like chewing a hank of old rope. Walzer's eyes were alight and curious. Desperately, I sought the elusive civil adjective. "It's pretty good," I told him.
"I commend your courtesy, but nonsense. I won't take offense, nor will Emil. Do it for Emil, hm?"
"You remember Emil." I peered at the pork. Walzer said,
"Go on. Assess the piquancy of Emil. It's all the memorial he's bound to get. Poor little Emil."
He was delighted the meat had a name. He couldn't use it enough. And yet, surprisingly, knowing the pale lump before me was Emil was not disturbing. In fact, it freed me up somehow. I chewed him up and swallowed him. "It's stiff," I said cautiously. "A little dry?"
Walzer said, "Go on."
"It's dull, blunt."
"Yes, yes."
Walzer liked this. A strange thing occurred. Adjectives, generally standoffish around me, began tossing themselves at my feet. "It's fibrous, rough, ropey." I was faintly aware of insulting Sarah's cookery, but Walzer was nodding, smiling. His favor was better than the alternative. I basked in it, and it was fun for a change, having the words. Dispirited, stagnant, mortified, vapid. I wasn't sure what the last one meant, having heard it from Swede in a discussion about her second-grade teacher, but it had a ring.
"Well said,"
Walzer declared, the only time I recall that compliment being applied to myself. "It tastes like cartilage," I added, wanting to get that one in.
"Yes, good. Now me."
Walzer took a small mouthful and worked it efficiently.
Yes.
He closed his eyes, swallowed, blew hard through his nostrils.
"I taste corn. Not so much corn as I'd like. Kernels and husks. I taste beans, bread, pigweed, grass, earth. Quite a lot of earth. Salt."
I realized he was describing Emil's diet. He looked pained.
"Unfortunately, I also taste slops. It's a hard gift. I've encountered flavors in sausages it would be obscene to describe."
Did I believe him? Doesn't matter. All this time, my lungs had worked tolerably well. I understand now this was a period of grace. Walzer went on treating me as though my presence honored him. Wary as I was, his manner was winning and his talk beguiling. Sarah stayed apart from us, behind her wall of quilts. Later, we stood outside the cabin, Walzer pointing out constellations while Davy went to saddle Fry.
"There's the Great Ring," he said. "And there's the totem. There's Hawk and Mouse, the whale, Boy Ready."
I could only nod. Having someone point out constellations is pleasant, as long as they don't insist that you actually see them. Aside from the Dipper and Orion and the Teapot, constellations tend to hide in the stars. "I never heard of Boy Ready," I said, as though the others were familiar to me. So he aimed at its points, one by one, and related the myth of a child who lived in a city of wood, and how one night the city caught fire and burned so fiercely that by morning nothing remained but a field of fine ash. Only the boy escaped. One day a passing pilgrim saw him crouched at the river, pursuing fish with his hands. The pilgrim took the boy on his horse to the next city, where he was fed and then celebrated as the tale of his survival spread. The boy charmed all with his bravery and wit, and was adopted by the king, and grew up trained in arms and letters. At last he became king himself, and was wise and good. It was a passable story until Walzer revealed that the boy had set the fire himself. "He couldn't have," I said.
"Of course he could. Calm down, Reuben, it's only a legend."
But all Walzer's constellations told such turned legends. There was the Bowsprit, about another rotten boy who slew his father while he slept and later became a fire-breathing pirate who devoured his victim's limbs and decorated the rail of his ship with their heads. This fellow tramped up and down the high seas, challenging men and gods, until a brave captain met him in battle, the two of them going sword and sword across decks for days without rest. At last the captain, by superior craft, cleft the other in two at an angle, so that the pirate's head with one arm and shoulder thumped on the deck with a terminal snarl. Job done, the captain returned to his ship to wash for dinner and looked in his polished brass mirror. You see what's coming. The poor captain saw not his own face, but the pirate's, and the nastiest grin all over it. Following this, all his noble impulses fell away like a male shirt, and he developed a wild, controlling lust for jeweled plunder and an appetite for boiled legs and arms.
"So you can win the battle, Reuben," Walzer shrugged, "but the war is lost long ago."
"Crumb," I reflected morosely, as Fry and Davy trotted up. Walzer put his altered hand on my head.
"Don't let it bother you," he said.
But it did. The next day, Martin Andreessen called. The fellow who'd given Davy a lift, name of Robinson, had promised to show Andreessen the place he dropped him off. They'd been going to meet at the Amadon Cafe, but Robinson never showed. There were three Robinsons in the phone book. Andreessen reached two. The third's telephone had been disconnected. Inquiring directions to the disconnected Robinson's house, Andreessen drove 8 rugged miles along the edge of the Badlands. The house he found there was cold and boarded.
"The situation, Martin," Dad said, "requires prayer."
I'd have given quite a bit to hear the Fed's response. Whatever it was, Dad said,
"Of course, we'll expect to hear from you."
Then hung up and called me over.
"Chest tight?"
he asked, a rhetorical question, for he could hear what had become the usual wheeze.
"Yes, sir. What can I do?"
He'd begun approaching it this way ever since Dr. Nichols threw cold water on the vinegar treatment. "Just pound a little." He turned me by the shoulders and I braced against the door jamb while he worked my back. Except for the thumping, it was a quiet morning, and when he stopped I could hear Roxanna humming in the next room.
"Better?"
"Yes, sir."
He listened. "Sounds about the same."
"It's better."
"Reuben," he said out of nowhere, "is there something you ought to be telling me?"
My insides gelled.
"I don't think so."
"You're looking peaked," he said.
"It wears, this whole thing, doesn't it?"
So it was only my health he was worried about.
"I'm going to the trailer and pray for your brother," he said.
Such sadness in his face, it was as though he knew something I didn't, instead of the reverse. No word arrived from Andreessen that day, or the next. What did arrive was a northwest wind that sang against the house. In the Dakotas, it needn't snow to blizzard. The wind came low and fast, peeling the drifts. From her window upstairs, Swede and I watched a cavalry charge minus the horses. Wide chunks of snow tore themselves off the ground and flung forward, tumbling to white sand that coiled and rushed like Huns. It was a ground wind, a ground blizzard. Picture a storm to match any in wildness, but only 8 feet high. From Swede's window, it was like looking down on a violent cloud. The barn protruded, its door invisible down inside the storm, and the handle of a snow shovel stuck in a drift, and Roxanna's red birdhouse on a tilting pole. Above the storm, it was actually sunny. We could see the gleaming tin dome of a neighbor's silo miles away. But when we went downstairs, drafts came from everywhere, and the light was gray and discouraging. And on the west wall, an electrical outlet glowed with frost, a foot from a ticking radiator. The wind lasted 2 days. Thinking of the cabin in the hills, with its shrunk, chinking, and corroded stove, I worried for Davy, also for Sarah. "Swede," I wondered, "how long till you'd freeze to death in a wind like this?
You mean with your clothes on?"
I bridled.
"Well, what do you think? How many people are going to go out in this with nothing on?"
"Nobody goes out with nothing on. It's something that happens when you begin to freeze. The thermometer in your brain gets turned around. You start thinking you're hot. Got too much on, you figure you'll cool off." I was buying none of this. Couldn't afford to.
Picturing Davy all bundled up in this wind was bad enough.
It's true, Reuben. It's like a mirage. The snow turns to desert. Once, two college boys snowshoeing out in Wyoming, they found him froze solid, standing up, snow to their waists, nothing on but boxer shorts. Police couldn't fit him in the car, so they tied him on top, like in deer season.
Goodness knows how long Swede might have continued in this way, so I said,
"What if you're in a rotten old cabin, cracks in the walls, and the wind blowing through?"
Well, that set Swede on another track, even more horrific. She related a story about some troop of outcasts running out of food at the onset of a record book blizzard, and how hungry they all got, eating their belts and boot tops, though not their lone horse, which had sensibly escaped, and how the weaker among them skidded away from reality and started gnawing their own limbs, smacking their lips, yet making, you'd have to say, no nutritional gain. As a tale of grew, it was badly timed. Walzer, too, had spoken of cannibalism, and in fact it seemed a thing he might practice without remorse. I descended to morbid reflections. Suppose the storm lasted a week. How much firewood did they have in that cabin, and how much food? With both Davy and Sarah on hand, I was certain Walzer would eat Davy first. He had other plans for Sarah. I spent a vicious wish on Andreessen. If only he were out there with Walzer. Then bring on a blizzard. But this bit of drama didn't satisfy, as I supposed it might. The Fed, to my puzzlement, seemed less putrid than he once had. Sitting by Swede as she read silently on the couch, I counted six of my breaths to each of hers. What I wanted was a great big inhale, or, failing that, a little peace. I ventured out to the airstream. Dad was playing the antique guitar. Stepping into the dimness of the barn, I heard its soft strings humming one lovely chord and then another. He was playing slowly yet precisely, for I heard no orphan notes. I stood listening while he played any number of quiet hymns, stopping sometimes to tune a string up or down. I don't mean he was already Segovia or anything. It was only days since he'd repaired the instrument with a tube of airplane glue and a Spanish windlass tied up from Long John's. Still, he had worked out many of the songs we loved in those days, Amazing Grace and Cast Your Eyes Upon Jesus, It Is Well With My Soul, also Happy Trails and The Cowboy's Lament. Sometimes Dad sang, sometimes hummed. Sometimes there was a long search for this or that desired chord. I could have listened all day. When he stopped and I heard him moving about inside the trailer, I eased from the barn and shut the door. Inside, Roxanna was stirring up bread, her latest hothouse blooms in a tin vase on the table, soup asteam in a pan, just as though we were a family, not perched at the edge of great loss. Even Swede seemed to have reached some sort of harbor. She sat in her room above the blizzard, fomenting joy for Sonny and his wife, now that they'd obliterated the entrance to their secret valley, as well as about half that rotten posse. The wind blew through a second night, stratifying snowbanks and encumbering roads. Then it wore out. The house fell quiet. After breakfast, the others went out to shovel. I was no good for it, but Dad said someone had to stay by the phone. I did so all morning, but Andreessen did not call. The afternoon idled along. I read Last of the Mohicans twice through, Classics Illustrated. Then got out Roxanna's scrapbook and revisited Jonas Werk's obit. None of this warded off agitation. None of it kept bad pictures away. Pictures of Davy drawn and freezing, of snow sifting through the unchinked shack. Concentrate as I might on Hawkeye and Uncas, Jape Walzer's tale of the cannibal pirate kept telling itself to my brain. Starring Jape, of course. It was a part written exactly for him, with his fetching confidence and lunatic glint. Like the pirate, you could imagine Jape Walzer winning even when he lost. This time the county plows reached us by late afternoon. Hearing nothing from Andreessen, Dad called his motel in Rathton. The owner, also desk clerk, took a message. His annoyance was audible in Roxanna's kitchen. He told Dad the federal man paid his bill readily enough, but was a great deal of trouble. Sometimes he left for days, returning to his room in the small hours. It disturbed the neighbors. And always the phone calls.
Federal men received many phone calls, and there was no telling when. The owner told Dad he was a businessman, not a secretary. From the office, he had to pull on his coat and boots and go down 5 doors to Mr. Andreessen's room. The messages were piling up. It was too cold for this.
"When did he leave?" Dad asked.
Suspending complaint, the owner thought this over. Early the previous day, he'd taken a call from one Mr. Robinson. He was in Amadon, at the cafe. Andreessen was glad for the message, had, in fact, the owner grouchily acknowledged, tipped him a $2 bill for its delivery. Not long afterward, the motel lot already turning humpy with drifts, the owner had watched Andreessen's tan Mercury creeping away through the wind. Dad hung up the phone. He stood to the window and looked west. The snow lay hard and clean-shaven, and the broken hills rose up out of it. I don't guess you could find more inhospitable geography. But the wind had stopped, and the cold sun put such an edge on hills and barn they might have been razored from a magazine.
"Rube," he said, "that Andreessen's a smart fella, but he doesn't know one thing about winter in North Dakota."
A thought dropped from nowhere like a big snake. Dad plucked his coat off the hook, heading to the trailer. I plucked mine to follow, then nearly sat down. My legs trembled, hips and kneecaps loose as dominoes.
"Something the matter?" Dad inquired.
"Yes, sir." I didn't want to say it, the thought. Yet it coiled around me, irresistible. It squeezed, and I yielded. "Mr. Andreessen's in bad trouble." He looked at me, and I at his shoes.
"What is it, Reuben?"
But the snake had me so hard I could barely speak. I sagged to the floor to shiver. What I saw was Walzer, telling of his first sight of Davy in the Amadon Cafe. I saw Andreessen, encouraged only days ago, having shown Davy's picture to the right man at last. Then Walzer again, from my final visit, comfortable, talking easily, refusing all concern at my insistence that Andreessen was drawing near.
"Reuben," Dad said.
It was too much to manage all at once, so I only replied, "His name isn't Robinson. It's Shape Walzer, and he's with Davy, and he's going to kill Mr. Andreessen."
The Ledger of Our Decisions. So I turned at last. So I betrayed my brother. Before daylight next morning, we assembled horseback at Lonnie Ford's ranch. I say we. The party included Mr. Ford, the young county sheriff, Mike Lands, a federal investigator, Harper Juvel, who'd driven in from Bismarck, and 3 ad hoc local deputies. The deputies were skittish, pleased at this chance to saddle up with scabbarded Winchesters and go hunting fugitives in the snow. Mr. Juvel looked them over without expression. 2 hours earlier, a rancher had found Andreessen's Mercury parked empty on a county road, actually blocking the road, snow to its fenders. As the hilltops pinked, it was briefly argued whether I had any business going.
"What are you, boy? About 9?
This was Mr. Juvel.
11, sir.
"He's the only one of us who's made the trip, Harper," said Lonnie Ford. "At least he can tell us if we're going right."
Of course, I'd never made the trip in daylight, so my usefulness was suspect in any case. Juvel examined me with distaste.
"Mr. Land," he said to Dad, "it's your call. Are you comfortable with your boy going?"
Dad wanted to go himself, but Juvel had nixed that the night before.
"He's up to it," Dad said. "I'm taking you at your word now."
For Juvel had promised that Davy would be taken quietly and without violence. Juvel nodded. Dad looked at me. I saw he was counting on me to see them quickly to the cabin. He wanted it over with, Davy safe, Andreessen alive. Perhaps he also believed that with Davy's little brother close by, the lawman would be less apt to shoot.
"Let's go, then," Juvel said, while Lonnie Ford boosted me onto a shaggy bay mare.
I remember Dad standing in the awakening barnyard, clapping softly to keep the blood in his fingers. We rode single file into the hills, heading for what Mr. Ford supposed, from my description, to be an old line cabin that had belonged to his ranch long before. It lay an indeterminate distance west in a valley fertile enough to offer some small pasture, yet remote enough that no cattle had grazed there in a generation.
Also, the pastor had cracked open to lignite in the late 30s and caught fire, which had a bewildering effect on livestock. For all Mr. Ford knew, it was burning to this day. So I felt we were heading in the right direction, though you may imagine what little comfort it gave me. Probably it won't surprise you that Swede took all this badly. That I'd kept Davy's secret from her, she judged the deepest kind of lie. That I'd revealed him didn't expunge the sin, but compounded it. I was both liar and traitor. I was an apostate. Before gaining forgiveness, I was to endure any number of historical comparisons, and not just with standard traitors like Judas and Brutus and Benedict Arnold. These were a fine start, but hardly enough for Swede, who remembered off the top of her head that it was little brother Ramon who betrayed the great bandito Joaquin Murrieta, whose bottled head still exists in a certain tavern in Texas. You could go in this very day and pay a dollar to lift a dark curtain and see it. She knew others, too. Any hopes I had of her rage being softened by my obvious misery proved groundless. She heard me out, then went upstairs to fling a tantrum unequaled in her history. I heard papers flying, weeping mixed with various wordless growls, and the sound of a pillow being kicked with tremendous gusto. That last, I knew, was me. It was a longer ride than I remembered. We rode up into timber breaks that felt familiar and along ridges of scrub pine and juniper where it seemed I'd never been. Wind had so driven the snow that in places a laden horse could walk atop it, leaving only shallow tracks, but mostly they sank to their knees, shod hooves tossing up traces of sand or scoria or fine needled ferns. There was time to roll all manner of films in my head. Bad endings prevailed. In order of riding, I came second after Mr. Ford and before Mr. Juvel, the three deputies strung out behind. After a time, we descended a long, even slope where there was room for Mr. Juvel to come abreast of me. He was on a bright palomino Mr. Ford had been loath to saddle. I believe, in fact, that Juvel paid extra for the palomino, and indeed he looked good on the animal as they came alongside. "We going the right way, then?" he asked. I feared his attention. Miserably, I admitted to having no idea. He rode at my side a while without comment. He was older than Dad, wore a short-brimmed cowboy hat, and had a clipped white beard and a web of wrinkles under his eyes. He sat straight-backed on the palomino, floating easily above the horse as it slugged through the snow. "I consider Martin Andreessen a friend," he said after a time. I nodded. "You don't, I guess."
"No, sir."
We were riding through a fairly open valley I might have recognized, but the wind had erased any tracks. We could have been the first people through in years.
"Well," he said, "I suppose you feel like a Hall of Fame turncoat just now, taking us to your brother?"
"Yes, sir, I do." Why did Mr. Juvel want to talk about it? He knew how I felt. Arriving late, he'd stayed up much of the night talking to Dad. They'd called me down in the wee hours so Juvel could ask me particulars. What weapons I'd seen in the cabin, what stocks of ammunition and food. At his request, I drew a layout of the place, showing windows, door, stove, and chimney. He wondered whether I got a peek at Sarah's quarters. He said the more I could tell him, the better things would be for Davy. He said this 4 or 5 times.
"You wish you'd kept quiet?" he asked.
"Davy's not the problem for your friend Andreessen," I told him. "It's Jape Walzer."
"So you mentioned."
Last night, Mr. Juvel had seemed, if not entirely in our corner, at least leaning toward it. When I told him about Walzer, his crazy mind, his ambivalence about Andreessen's proximity, even Walzer's own characterization of himself as a wolf to Davy's squirrel, Mr. Juvel had listened with evident interest. He made notes on a yellow pad, as though each detail confirmed this Walzer as a long-sought bad man, it would be an honor to catch. He'd said, "Yes, yes." Now he seemed much less accommodating. Anxious for reassurance, I took an ingratiating tone. "Mr. Juvel, what's Jape Walzer wanted for? What did he do?" The slope had leveled off, and his palomino was edging restlessly ahead. Juvel reined back long enough to give me a look I've never forgotten. not a mean look or disrespectful, the look perhaps of years spent in disappointment. He said,
"Son, you got to remember something. Your brother killed two boys last year, then broke jail. This Robinson, Walter, whatever his name is, I don't know him from Adam."
He let the reins fall against the horse's neck and trotted up to talk to Lonnie Ford. We were getting close, riding now through country I knew for certain, yet we'd slowed. Lonnie Ford, leading, stopped to squint from time to time. The wind was getting teeth, lashing the horse's tails along their flanks and tilting Mr. Juvel's cowboy hat over his eyes. Under this faltering progress, I had time to think it all over, to doubt what had appeared conclusive. The nearer we came to the cabin, the more likely it seemed that the enigmatic Robinson really wasn't Jape Walzer, that he was simply what Mr. Andreessen had supposed, a fellow who'd given Davy a ride, then acquired cold feet about talking to a federal man. So what that Andreessen hadn't found him in the phone book? Lots of people didn't have telephones. So what that Walzer was unconcerned when I arrived all aflap about the putrid Fed? It was senseless to give meaning to his reactions. The man talked about sea monsters. He steered by stars of his own invention. The idea emerged, seeming true the moment it wiggled free, that I'd betrayed my brother needlessly. That Andreessen, while he'd gone out foolishly in a dangerous storm, was in no danger from any Robinson. I sat the bay mare, recognition of my blunder attached to my heart like a leech. Up ahead, Lonnie Ford, who'd been consulting with Mr. Juvel in some serious matter, turned his horse and loped back to me through the snow. Unlike the self-contained Mr. Ford of my constructions, he was a nervous man with clear misery in his face. He rode up, so our two horses met shoulder to shoulder. They rubbed necks, but Lonnie didn't say anything to me, or even look at me. He kept gazing off to his left. "Is something the matter, Mr. Ford?" He nodded. I saw he was a man for whom words were a desperate problem. I felt bad for him, though it did give me a lift somehow.
"I lease the ranch," he said, after another hard moment. "I never saw this cabin before. I told Mr. Juvel that."
It took me a second to see where this placed us.
"Does any of this look right to you?" asked Lonnie Ford.
He looked at me sideways. Anguished is not too strong a word. Then nodded at the hills around us.
"Any of it?"
My first thought was that God, in my disconsolate hour, had slid open a hatch. Lonnie Ford didn't know where we were. The fellow guiding us to Davy was asking me for directions. Suppressing dizzy yelps, I took stock. We were on the west gradient of a gently beveled hill, ringed above with twisted jackpine and scrub juniper and larger trees like cedars. Ahead to the left rose exhilarating cut rock cliffs of sandstone and scoria and some school brick colored clay. I knew where we were, all right. Knew, moreover, if we bore to the left, behind the cliffs, we'd be steering away from Davy. Lonnie Ford said quietly,
"I told Mr. Juvel."
Behind us, the deputies, blown clean of jocularity, had begun to mutter. Up front, Juvel sat the Palomino, looking like a man set on winning by any means. Some day, you know, we're going to be shown the great ledger of our recorded decisions. A dread concept you nonetheless know in your deepest soul is true. "We have to bear left," I told Lonnie Ford. It was a slick climb in places, a steep one in others, and no one really wished to make it. According to my misdirection, Lonnie Ford trotted forward, and I saw him pointing and nodding with something like assurance. Juvel reached in a saddlebag and withdrew a large pair of binoculars and trained them on the slope of rock and snow-swept talus that would take us up behind the cliffs. I remember he peered through those glasses for a long time, then put them down and turned and looked at me, a trenchant gaze I couldn't return. He swung about, and up we went. We climbed strung out, so a skidding horse wouldn't panic the others. Perhaps it didn't seem as bad an ascent to me as to the rest, no natural rider. I exercised no authority over the mare, whose footing was like a guarantee. At the bottom lay a repose of burst sandstone, as though a vast slab or reef had breached from the height of land and slid rupturing down. The route then narrowed to a generous yew, higher on the right than left and occupied by a tribe of twisted dwarf evergreens. Only gradually did the incline become less manageable, narrowing first to a V, so it was like walking in the bow of a very small boat, then lifting before us until we leaned close over the horses' necks and felt gravity looking for a hold. Briefly, I feared for my deception, that Mr. Juvel would throw off the climb as impossible and turn us back on course. Perhaps he would have, had the way been wide enough for a horse to turn. Yet we gained the top. For a steep instant below the rim, the mare seemed to balance upright, my heels at her haunches, arms around her neck, face in her mane. Then she lurched and broke forward, coming out on level earth. There was the big, cold sky moving over us. Juvel and Lonnie Ford had dismounted to wait, their animals blowing and shaking their heads. I confess to a certain exaltation. My artifice had worked. The cabin lay somewhere to the right, in a valley. Our way now lay clearly to the left. We were on a mesa of sorts, where wind had removed all snow, except a tan layer from which dead grasses poked. I slipped off the mare and stood beside her like the other men, while the deputies struggled over the crest one by one. There on the mesa we enjoyed a prevalent good humor, even if my reasons were unique. Sheriff Lands poured coffee in a thermos lid and passed it around. The deputy who'd followed me up, name of Fitker, came over and told me how he was sorry to be hunting my brother. Lonnie Ford, and this ached, shook my hand. His eyes were so grateful they appeared damp, though this was probably an effect of the wind. Only Juvel remained detached. While the rest of us stretched with relief, he swung back on the Palomino and trotted to a small rise atop the cliffs. Profiled against sky, he looked like Robert E. Lee. He had his binoculars out. "Ford," he called. The rancher was sipping coffee. He sighed, handed it off, and heaved aboard. He came alongside Juvel, who passed him the glasses. Adjusting them to his eyes, he looked over the valley. The wind snaked across the mesa. I'd been warm from the climb, but no more. The grasses hissed like wire. Ford dismounted, sat down cross-legged, elbows on knees. He leaned into the binoculars. Next thing, the two of them were trotting back to us, Juvel looking official and stormy, and Ford unreadable. Juvel coughed and spat. "It's back down then, gentlemen," he said, and with barely a pause, rode to the rim we'd all been so pleased to master and dropped over. Nobody spoke. We were listening to the Palomino's hooves sliding on rock and dirt. I felt people looking at me, but perhaps no one was. I know Lonnie Ford wasn't, for later he didn't look at me even when I wished he would, or even again so far as I know. In a few words, he'd told the men we'd come the wrong way. Mr. Juvel had discerned the cabin lying down the valley. You might expect some outburst from men so informed, but there was none. I felt instead a hush. To say I felt like a caught sneak doesn't touch it. I was a boy caught deceiving honest men. I went over next to last, just a single deputy behind. If you've never essayed a decline like that on the back of a horse, I don't know what to tell you. There's a separation from ground and a hopeless union with the animal as down you go. Can't hear a thing but gravel clatter. Absolutely can't steer. The mare laid her ears back, splayed her front feet, set haunches to earth, and slid. Far below, I could see Juvel and the sheriff standing beside their mounts. Lonnie Ford was in front of me by some yards. His horse, a big-barreled Roman-nosed quarter, began to skid sideways. I saw it happen. Hind quarters bearing right, hooves scrabbling, the horse seeking balance. Then its wayward back leg struck a boulder, and the horse went down. Mr. Ford was a man of size, but he just disappeared. The horse slid forward on its side, neck up, trying to rise. You'd have thought it would slow. It flipped once, hooves every place, then hit a steep drop and flipped again. All this time, I was skidding along behind on the mare. At last, the gradient eased, and the down horse stopped. It lay in the path at an alien angle. My mare clattered to a halt beside it, the last deputy arriving behind me in a spray of broken stone.
"Where's Ford?"
the deputy said, swinging down. We couldn't see him. The way that horse had slid, it wouldn't have surprised me to have to gather Ford up a limb at a time. We did locate one spurred boot sticking out from under the horse. There was nothing in the boot but a sock. The horse was in awful shape. After that second flip, it couldn't raise its head and lay trembling on the rubble. The others had joined us in mute shock, except for Juvel, who passed us at an angry trot, ordering, "Don't you shoot that animal!" He headed back up the hill and stopped beside a ragged, dirty clot mostly hidden by a dwarf pine. He didn't immediately get off the horse, but gazed down at the clot like you would at something loathsome. That Lonnie Ford lived at all commends the resilient design of humans, the rib cage in particular. Ford's rib cage, and it was a big one, was rolled over not once but twice by an entire American quarter horse, yet his organs remained whole. The rest of Ford was worse off. His arm lay twisted behind in such a way Sheriff Lands diagnosed a broken collarbone. Over one shoulder, a hole had been rubbed through jacket, shirt, and skin. He was down to muscle. His face on the same side was swelling purple as we watched. The only place on him that looked okay was his bare right foot. He was unconscious, which relieved us all. The sheriff had done stints as an ambulance man and had a kit in his saddlebag. He worked on Ford where he lay, checking ribs, pasting up the shoulder, easing the arm out to the side. When, with Juvel's help, he realigned the collarbone, Ford woke a moment to thrash, then sank as though clubbed. The sheriff directed a jury-rigged stretcher of poles and tied coats. While they moved Ford to even ground, Juvel put a hand on my neck and steered me to a place some yards from the others. He asked, "Did you misdirect me on purpose?" When I didn't answer immediately, Juvel said, "Son." His tone implied, if not gentleness, at least understanding.
"Yes, I did, sir."
Juvel cuffed the right side of my head so hard I spun to my knees. Next thing, he gripped one shoulder and set me back on my feet, saying, "Listen to me now." It was difficult, as a high tone occupied my right ear. But Juvel earnestly told me 5 or 6 specific things he found discouraging about my character. If you don't mind, I'd rather not restate them, but they were by and large true. And, seeing no advantage in disputing the more captious charges, I agreed with them all, as the broken must. Concluding, he said, "You're pretending, aren't you, to have remorse?" If not for the belt in the ear, I'd have quickly reassured him my misery was authentic. But as I said, I wasn't hearing well. I thought he was asking, did I feel bad about the horse?
"Yes, sir," I said.
He cuffed me again, same ear, and walked back to the men while I knelt in the snow. They made Lonnie Ford as snug as possible, carrying him into a short thicket and laying him on a bed of gathered juniper. Though unconscious, the rancher had begun to twitch and mutter. When Juvel was satisfied Ford wouldn't freeze solid, he gathered the others, who checked cinches and spoke unhappily among themselves as they climbed aboard. Only now did I see they were leaving me with Ford and going to hunt Davy without me.
"Did you think we'd have you along all the way?" Juvel asked. "We'd have stationed you back with the deputy anyway. Now you'll just have to keep an eye on Ford."
The Palomino wheeled about.
Lucky I was muzzy from being hit. More lucid, I might have wept for grief and outrage. As it was, all I thought to do was yell, "What should I do if he wakes up?"
"Tell him a story,"
Juvel called back, his voice already reduced against the Badlands. Looking back, though, it was better to be stuck with poor Lonnie Ford than be babysat by a deputy. It gave me work. It kept my mind from the aches in head and soul. Every time despair came courting, Mr. Ford would moan and thrash. I held his limbs when he dreamed and rebunched his juniper pillow. After a bit, he started to shiver. His whole body seemed to contract and stiffen. It was spooky, a skeleton dance, and I wondered what it would be like if Mr. Ford died and I had to stay who knew how long beside his body. What if it got dark? What we wanted was a fire. Which sent me back to the horse. I'd forgotten about him, the poor downed animal lying a few yards away. He was alive, though resigned, the side of his belly rising and falling, nothing else moving but his eyes. I opened the accessible saddlebag, for he was lying upon the other, and took out a can of all-purpose oil, a heavy black pouch containing harness and leather punch and other tools more foreign. Also a book called Old American Houses, with a stained blue dust jacket. At bottom lay a small concave bottle of whiskey, wrapped against concussion in a chambray shirt. For whiskey or against whiskey, you had to admire that bottle. Battered down a hillside, bounced on by a horse, with its swaddling peeled away, it lay like an amber ornament in my hand. The red paper seal was unbroken. The horse sighed heavily. An animal that size gives off so much heat, I'd snuggled against its belly. It seemed to like the company, and since Lonnie Ford wasn't making any noise, I stayed a while. I knew the horse should have been shot after the fall. The only reason he wasn't was our nearness to Davy's cabin. Juvel wanted to preserve surprise. I tried to brace up, to think of anything besides the likelihood of gunshots from the hills. We were awfully close, within a mile certainly, and the men had already been gone some time. Half an hour? How long could it take? I imagined Juvel quietly issuing his orders, the men spreading out, staying low. Swede had told me how the James gang were ambushed in a farmhouse in exactly this way. My decision to tell Dad everything now lay revealed as foolishness. Swede was right. I was among the disgusting double-crossers of history. I was one of the crumbs. Cole Younger, you will recall, came out of that farmhouse with 11 gunshot wounds. I didn't think Davy could survive 11 gunshot wounds. I hoped he'd come out with his hands up when offered the chance. I hoped Mr. Juvel would give him the chance. I had doubts, despite his promise to Dad. I doubted lawmen in general. Cole Younger was sitting in a kitchen chair, Swede said, reading a newspaper, when so many rifles started popping, the house shredded like paper mache. Among his other wounds were porcelain shards in arm and face. Cup of coffee got shot right out of his hand. Then I wondered what Davy would think, should he surrender, to see me there with Juvel and the rest. Somehow this hadn't entered my thinking till now, but it made up for lost time. In this picture I saw no forgiveness for myself. Not from Davy, not from Swede, not from anyone but Dad, who was so forgiving it almost didn't count. It seemed necessary just then to touch base with the Lord. Shutting my eyes, I leaned into the horse. I prayed in words for a little while, for Davy, of course, and for Mr. Ford, whom I could hear making chewing sounds in his sleep, and for my own future,